Hello and welcome to the War Studies podcast. I'm Peter Busch, and today we'll bring you episode 4 of our expert series. This episode is looking into the 2011 pro-democracy demonstrations in China, also often called the Jasmine Revolution. We talk to Professor Kerry Brown, the director of King's China Institute, about this earlier this year in March. Welcome to Experts, a podcast series produced by students in the Department of War Studies with interviews of academics, bringing you new perspectives on war, conflict, and the media. I'm Peter Busch, presenting the hard work and research of my third-year students who are taking the module called New Wars, New Media, New Journalism. Today's episode is produced by Corey, Jamie, and Bahia. This podcast will focus on the use of social media and the internet during the Chinese Jasmine Revolution of 2011. There has been little research on the subject compared to its counterpart in the Middle East and North Africa. And this podcast will analyze the reasons of the different outcomes in these two regions dominated by authoritarian regimes. Dr. Kerry Brown, professor of Chinese politics and director of the Lao China Institute here at King's, provides an important contribution to the field through his research. But before we dive into the detail of the use of social media during the Chinese Jasmine Revolution, Jamie will provide us with a brief overview of the events that unfolded in 2011 and their outcomes.
The 2011 Chinese pro-democracy protests, also known as the Chinese Jasmine Revolution, refers to the demonstrations that were inspired by a call for greater transparency and democracy, which started on the 20th of February 2011 and spread over a dozen cities in China. These protests were inspired by the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia. The demonstrations in China were initiated online with an anonymous call for a Jasmine Revolution, first on the Boxing.com website, which was managed by overseas dissidents, and later on Twitter. The aim of the dissidents was to take action to show the Chinese government that the people of China expect more transparency and accountability that does not currently exist under the one-party rule. However, the Chinese Communist Party was quick and efficient in suppressing these dissident voices. In fact, due to the use of the police to crack down on popular protests and the use of the internet to censor words such as Jasmine and Egypt, the demonstrations did not attain the final aim.
Most scholars praise the beneficial and democratizing efforts that social media have, often neglecting its limitations. Thus, China is the perfect example of how social media can be used by authoritarian regimes as a tool to control the thinking of citizens and manipulate information. This forms part of Dr. Kerry Brown's research, who is an expert on how the Communist Party in China functions. I sat down with Kerry to get a better understanding of how the CCP uses the internet to its advantage. When we talk about the Jasmine Revolution, a term that was, of course, adopted from the Arab Spring, why didn't the call for pro-democracy protests that also started in China achieve maybe similar results?
I mean, in the People's Republic of China, there was a huge amount of preemptive effort by security service and others to make sure that social media wasn't going to spread ideas about protesting. And that's not just because of what happened in the Arab Spring. That's because of what happened in the color revolutions in the mid-2000s. And so there was a huge amount of effort to make sure that the internet in China is very well policed and that these kind of pieces of information don't get through. And also because there just isn't really a viable movement at the moment, a democracy movement, because it's been so well repressed. You know, since the attempt in the 1990s to set up a China Democracy Party in Hangzhou, since then, you know, that was really kind of dealt with harshly and people given long sentences. I mean, maybe this will change in the future, but the situation now is if you try and organize any opposition to the Communist Party, you will immediately attract attention. And the fact is that surveillance is so pervasive that it doesn't really, you can't really build up any sort of momentum and get any kind of membership without drawing attention to yourself. I think, you know, the Communist Party of China might be paranoid, but their paranoia has been pretty effective because they've made any kind of opposition not really viable. So the idea that they're democracy activists that would be able to use the Arab Spring, I didn't see any evidence of that at the time. I saw the Chinese government get probably over responsive and sort of nervous about the possibility, but I didn't see any kind of real signs of anything approaching.
The origins of the Chinese Jasmine Revolution can indeed be found in the uprisings that started in Tunisia in 2011. However, as Carrie Brown expressed in his interview, the outcomes were totally different in China as the uprising was quickly suppressed by the CCP. Bahia will now provide us with a comparison between the Middle East and China.
At the time of the revolution, global media platforms spurred discussions about a Chinese Arab Spring, enhancing the domino effect that was so feared by the Chinese government. The complaints shouted by protesters in both the Middle East and North African states in China were similar. These included calls for food, work, housing, and fairness. The police presence in both cases was immediate and overwhelming, and the social drivers of unrest in both cases were similar, with discontent being over corruption, unemployment, growing socioeconomic inequality, and rising prices, entangled with overall social instability. Corruption specifically is at the same level in both China and Tunisia and Egypt. The use of social media platforms by civilians, specifically Twitter, in both cases was paramount to the spread of the revolution and the support. However, it is paramount to note that the magnitude and depth of the sequence of events was different. One key example is the difference in media manipulation and censorship. China opted for more media manipulation, and the Middle East and North African states were more direct in their censoring. For example, China opted to suppress mentions of the protests and telecommunications, whereas Egypt shut down telecommunications completely. Media manipulation proved to be strategically beneficial in the case of China. The Chinese government was also strategic in their suppressing, with efforts to prevent a revolution demonstrated by their organization of political campaigns against corruption. Ultimately, the consequences of revolutions were fundamentally different, with the MENA regions overall experiencing regime change and daily violence, resulting for the most part in regional instability. China did not undergo any regime change, and the violence was suppressed in arrests and censoring.
In the Arab context, a lot of media blackouts were used in 2011, and in China was probably more like manipulation and censorship. Is this right, or can you maybe elaborate on this?
Well, because of the Great Firewall of China, because of the very, very strong control over any media, I mean, of course, news did get in. You know, people were aware. If you want to find out news, usually you can. But that's not a huge number of people. So more kind of media or internet savvy, you know, younger people or activists that are sort of operating individually in China. They knew what was happening, but it doesn't really get through to the rest of the population. And for them, the news is, you know, kind of given by the sort of central news agencies. And for, most of them would have reported the Arab Spring as being, you know, kind of horrible unrest that destabilized an area and that would be very undesirable. So they would have controlled the grand story, as it were, the narrative.
And as you say, well, back to the beginning, maybe in 2011 and the Arab Spring, when there was talk that maybe social media might help to liberate or it might help people to express their opinions. So do you think that China even then realized that this tool, social media, could be used in this
way? Not in the beginning. I think they had the same kinds of concerns and worries as others. But I think they've really learned in the last 15 to 20 years how to use it. And they've been very effective at that. So, you know, it's been a learning phase. I don't think that they had a cast iron idea at the beginning, like anything new. It's a very good case of the sort of the party state in China being a learning state and an adaptive kind of state.
In a wider sense, are there almost a model for more authoritarian regimes in doing that and in policing that space, the media space?
Yeah, so China has certainly taught countries and learnt from countries like Russia although that's a different kind of use of the internet. It's been of interest to other totalitarian regimes like Vietnam. You can see others in more autocratic kind of environments now across Asia look at China and think, you know, this is kind of shows what you can do if you really want to. And so it's got the right framework to really use the internet and social media in ways which are conducive and helpful to it. You could even say that some democratically elected leaders, you know, Duterte in Philippines and elsewhere, have also looked at what China does with interest. So it's kind of a, you know, surprising thing in 2019 to say that, you know, China in some ways has won this battle so far, and that wasn't expected 20 years ago. It really wasn't.
As we have seen, social media and the internet can play an important role in democratizing societies. However, this is largely dependent on how the internet is controlled by the state. Now, Corey will talk about how social media and the internet can in some cases strengthen the state's control over society rather than democratize news coverage.
Despite the spread of Chinese blogs exposing official corruption in the early 2000s, the effectiveness of media suppression in limiting the Jasmine protests to just a few hundred people suggests predictions that the internet would encourage democratic revolution were premature. Yet the CCP did not strangle the revolution through censorship alone. Instead, counter-messaging and surveillance through Chinese social media are its tools of choice. Some 300,000 online commentators promote rumors that discredit opposition to the regime, and social media openly identifies citizens who attempt to organize movements that threaten the party to the authorities. Greater internet penetration, then, has magnified Chinese sovereignty rather than undermined it. Yet the party has had to distinguish between allowing the expression of common grievances online and silencing calls for collective action, which Dr. Ivan Franceschini of the Australian National University argues enables the party to maintain legitimacy despite these practices.
So to what extent are social media then also used to do something about this discontent? So counter-messaging, for example, does this happen also apart from direct maybe police repression?
Yeah, I mean, the kind of social media in China is largely controlled because, you know, the Chinese have controlled their internet sovereignty and the, you know, WeChat, Weixin and Weibo that used to be quite popular. It's not so popular now. And others, you know, they're kind of the only things that are really available, and they are very well policed. And then others like Twitter and these things are not, you know, kind of allowed. So you've really controlled your domestic cyberspace. And, you know, that's kind of interesting because cyberspace is meant to be a global public common. And yet in China, it's like a kind of extension of the sovereign, you know, the sovereignty of the state. It's almost got a physical, you know, kind of space that it occupies, and it can't go beyond that. So when there's social protest, up to a point, people can express themselves. But I mean, because there's such good kind of search engines and kind of surveillance technology now, surprisingly quick, you know, the party immediately or the you know, the security services immediately get involved. So far, it's been very effective. It's been very, very effective.
So in this sense, there's also a surveillance aspect of social media that you find quite important to mention in this context.
Yes. I mean, it's like a two-way mirror. I mean, I think sometimes the image is that social, you know, kind of social media is like a one-way mirror where, you know, the user can use it to sort of, you know, kind of look out into the world. But it's also a way in which the government can use it to look into people. And you know, it's this sort of thing which has been very, very unexpected, that the kind of party state has made it into a two-way kind of window where not only can people look out of it, but it can look in, and it's seeing things it could never see before. So it's given it an enormous amount of power. And I think that duality was never really recognized at the beginning, because I think, you know, obviously the environments in which social media grew up were ones which were liberal and, you know, kind of it was about empowering the individual and freedoms of speech. That's true. But I mean, of course, there's always a kind of another dimension to this, which is, you know, the state is also able to use these things for its own ends, too. And in China, it's been able to use them for really finding out what people think. As I say, this all might change one day. It might well be the thing that does disrupt power in China. But at the moment, it seems to have made the central party state even stronger.
How do you think that the Chinese population react to well, the knowledge that there's propaganda, but also that there's surveillance? Are they aware of it?
Almost certainly people are. The majority of people that I talk to and know in China, you know, my circle of friends, they're very good at building networks around them. You know, China is a very network society, and they're kind of, you know, they are very capable of using social media to enable that. They appreciate the way that the internet is and social media is a great business resource. They're perfectly aware of what the government is doing, and they're pragmatic, because at the moment, you know, the majority of people find the kinds of business opportunities and network opportunities enough, and they have the freedoms they want. So I don't think anyone is under any illusion. They all know what the government does, but that's the thing. They don't really think it's a huge issue for them at the moment. I think they're probably a group that find it very irritating. You know, they do want privacy now. There's a sense of the private in China. And I think this violates that. That kind of irritation is common. But I mean, I don't think that they see an easy alternative to the political situation they're in at the moment, because they see, you know, a lot of kind of confusion and division in America and Europe and elsewhere. And so I think at the moment they just put up with the status quo. All of that could change very quickly. But as of the, you know, at the moment, I think the status quo suits people, suits the majority of people, and that's why they stick with it.
Despite the open and democratic nature of social media, the case of China demonstrates that, quote, the dark side of surveillance, unquote, as David Lyon put it, cannot be underestimated. Because of the horizontal and open nature of the internet, everyone can access social media. And governments can use social media to insert propaganda messages and as a powerful censorship tool. As explained by Dr. Kerry Brown, the Chinese Communist Party has quickly responded to any movement of dissent, and the internet has not played a major democratizing role. In this regard, it would be good to have more academic research, to know more about the role of social media and the internet in China. Because although the internet seemed to have made the central party even stronger, Kerry Brown pointed out that, quote, this might one day all change. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Experts. It was produced by Corey, Jamie, and Bahia. Thanks a lot for listening, and do check out the other episodes in this podcast series. Goodbye.